We're XOG and we're enough. And we're great at doing stuff.
Oh my God. Hello and welcome to Expected Own Goals. I am your host, Eric Morgan.
And I'm Evan Davis. Yeah, international break. Here we come. Doc isn't here. It's a bummer. She's preparing her life and
Doc
shit.
Doc has a life. We don't, apparently.
If there is anything about the United States' seventh She Believes Cup victory, it's the end of the Twyla Kilgore era. Cue the one shining moment montage.
This was not the most riveting women's sports that was available to watch this weekend, but we're not here to talk about South Carolina's excellence and how a team beat an individual.
Did you see Dawn Staley was at PSG Barcelona today?
No, I didn't, but that's great.
She was at the Parc des Princes with Aja Wilson.
Ugh, I love that.
Well, first of all, yesterday, Tuesday, was a little nuts in that you had seven games that were all nominally important and quote-unquote competitive, whether it was Sweden and France in Euros qualifiers, England and Ireland, Netherlands and Norway, Morocco, Zambia, Nigeria, and South Africa deciding the final two Olympic spots, which end up going to Zambia and Nigeria, and then, of course, Japan, Brazil, and USA, Canada in the She Believes Cup. There was a ton of, on paper, great women's soccer games, all in like an eight-hour window on Tuesday morning and afternoon, depending on your coast. But man, none of the games were good.
I didn't watch Zambia, Morocco, but it seemed like that might have been a good game.
It had some juice. It just wasn't well played.
Yeah, okay, sure. And props to Zambia for going to the Olympics. They'll be in a group with the United States, who we should eventually get around to. How do we feel about the She Believes Cup?
I want to get on my hobby horse for a second. The U.S. Soccer Federation really loves to tout the winner and the pomp and circumstance and the significance of the She Believes Cup, and has done so ever since they invented it in 2016. But it's a cash cow. It's a friendly tournament. It doesn't mean shit. When you see memes of, whoa, Alyssa Nair, Emily Sonnet, seven-time She Believes Cup winners, like, who gives a shit? This doesn't mean anything. This is all to close out the Twyla Kilgore era, blood some more talent, try and see if a lineup is really starting to take shape for the Olympics in July, and ready the handoff to Emma Hayes. That's all we should really care about when it comes to the She Believes Cup, particularly with this year's format, which is different because the Gold Cup took the normal slot for it, which means each team only played two games and they didn't play everybody in the thing. So the U.S. didn't play Brazil.
Well, thank God they'd already done that.
Right, in the Gold Cup final. So I don't really care about the She Believes Cup. My favorite thing about the She Believes Cup is when the Athletic's Steph Yang in 2016 made a meme of it with a Shiba Inu with a lion's mane of fallen autumn leaves around its head called the Shiba Leaves.
Shiba Leaves.
That's the best part about the She Believes Cup.
Yeah, for me, it is just a well-branded set of friendlies.
You know what? 50,600 people were at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium for USA-Japan. That's an all-time record for a U.S. game on U.S. soil outside of the 99 World Cup.
Really healthy crowd in Columbus as well.
Almost 20,000, yeah.
For the quote-unquote final. We talk a lot about like marketing. At least the She Believes Cup is well-marketed.
Extremely. And that's why it was invented. Like it was a chance to give the U.S. more opportunities to play top competition that they normally wouldn't be able to play, given that they're in CONCACAF, and to generate a regular revenue stream on non-tournament years. So in that respect, it's been a wildly successful tournament, but the U.S. has won seven of the nine.
They're dressed up friendlies. I'll say this. You are not a serious soccer tournament if after 90 minutes we go to penalties.
Ooh, so those years that the Copa America did that, you weren't a fan?
It's not that I'm not a fan, it's that I'm not a fan. I just mean any time in a competition that you're not willing to go the 120, it says we're not really like risking life limb to get the result. We're just kind of going to penalties.
Yeah, and frankly, who wants to risk life and limb for this?
No, not for the She Believes Cup. Not at all. The theme of all of it was just the United States kept creating problems for themselves and solved their way out of them.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the big difference than what we had seen even in the Gold Cup or in the group stage of the Gold Cup was second half adjustments did seem to make a difference. Whether it was bringing on Mallory Swanson, moving Jaden Shaw off the wing and into the 10 against Canada.
Bringing on Soph Smith and not starting her against Japan.
Those little wrinkles were significant. I'm not sure that Futoshi Ikeda got his lineups totally right against the U.S., even though they flew out of the traps and stole a goal within 30 seconds, forcing a listener mistake.
It's a not particularly good XG chance that ends up getting slotted home.
I think that the U.S. is demonstrating some degree of adaptability, and whether that's increased familiarity with Emma Hayes and Twyla Kilgore's plans, or if some sense is being knocked into Kilgore, I don't know. But they did look sharper in the second halves against both Japan and against Canada.
Particularly against Canada, there was real dominance throughout the first half of the game, and we'll get to the Alyssa Nair of it all in a little bit. But other than one sort of grievous error, I kind of felt like the U.S., even though the Mal Swanson sub at halftime was a positive one, and I think yet further ratcheted up the intensity that the U.S. had been applying, it was sort of one-way traffic a little bit in the first half, too. And then it was really one-way traffic. Once Canada won the penalty, they were a Khadija Buchanan 6-inch lower header from victory. It would not have been a big deal if the United States had lost here. But the United States, despite outplaying Canada, put themselves in a position to lose that game because of some pretty awful individual mistakes. And I think that that still plagues the team.
Without Naomi Girma's pace, Adriana Leon's first goal happens. Because Girma isn't there to close down once the ball goes over the top. Davidson just doesn't have the pace for it.
Instead, we get the 2023 Chicago Red Stars. And that was a historically bad defense.
If there's something to connect that goal with maybe an underlying issue that remains, it's that Japan's goal against the team more or less comes from the same play. It just comes much, much earlier. And Nair's defensive problems just look a little bit different. But whether it's Jenna Niswonger or it's Crystal Dunn, the left side was staying extremely high. And a very, very simple long ball all of a sudden opened up whoever the left-sided center back was on a total island. If you're Girma, you can handle that a little bit better if it's later in the game against Japan. And if it's not Girma, you can't really handle it at all. Somebody pointed this out, that Mexico's kind of tactical masterstroke was recognizing that if you sent balls over the top during the Gold Cup on the left side, that meant Jackie Ovalle could face up 1v1 against Becky Sauerbrunn, and Sauerbrunn was going to lose that battle every single time. It seems to be this continual issue that despite Niswonger's and Dunn's defensive skills, they're being asked to perform a role that leaves holes, and as good as Sam Coffey is, she can't be everywhere at once. That, I think, is probably something that they need to think about. I don't think it's a catastrophic issue that can't be fixed, but it does need to be acknowledged that in order to try and generate some attacking width by keeping your left back in the attacking third for a lot of the game, all of a sudden there's just all of this space that no one seems to be able to properly address, and then a goalkeeper at a listener's level only makes worse.
The problem is this, and I worry about how entrenched a listener is at this point.
I don't think you need to worry. I think it is a fact. It is going to happen for the Olympic tournament unless Emma Hayes just drops an absolute bomb in 7 weeks' time.
In a weird way, though, one could extract nothing from the Gold Cup semifinal against Canada. This was sort of a mirror image of that game in a lot of ways. Down to Alyssa Nair costing a goal and then kind of looking like a hero in penalties.
But saving some absolute garbage pens.
Canada, oh my God.
That's the second game in a row against the U.S. where your penalty shootout looked like ass.
Just unbelievably awful.
I tweeted it. At this point, Alyssa Nair is a better penalty taker than she is a penalty saver, despite what you think she did in those shootouts.
The mistakes that continue to happen that take wins off the board and result in the United States playing in penalty shootouts, those are real problems that I don't feel are very hard to diagnose.
No.
And ones that I just kind of can't imagine anyone with just even the slightest inclination towards analytics looking at Alyssa Nair and saying, this person should ever start another game for the U.S. women.
And because of the way that goalkeeping works, it's too late. There's just no time to get Casey Murphy or Jane Campbell or Robert Kingsbury ready to be the number one for the Olympics. It is going to have to be Nair. Nair is going to make a mistake. It's going to cost the U.S. a result at some point in the tournament. And then after the Olympics, that's when Emma Hayes has to say enough's enough. Because this decision should have been made in September when Twyla Kilgore first took over the team. That would have given Murphy or Campbell or Kingsbury enough time to get ready. We're a little over 3 months from the Olympics starting. The ship has sailed. It's inevitable. The discourse around Alyssa Nair really makes me want to blow a gasket. I mean, it's not a new story if you've been listening to this podcast for a long time. She's Derek Jeter ranging to her left. Saving multiple penalties in a penalty shootout looks impressive and seems cool. But if she didn't screw up the little things 20 minutes earlier, they would not have had to go to that penalty shootout and then would have won the game in normal time. So I've been thinking about everybody assuming that Bayern Munich men are imploding this season because Leverkusen are going to pip them to the Bundesliga title. But if you peer underneath the hood, Bayern Munich have been excellent. It's pretty much all down to the fact that Manuel Neuer is not having a good year, letting savable balls into the net, which are costing them points. Like, that's all it really comes down to. Everybody wants to say, oh, mentality, psychology, chemistry. It's just Neuer's having a bad season. There's some bad luck, and it's the reverse over here.
For the U.S., I think that we are long past the point of saying Alyssa Nair is having a wobble. It's that Alyssa Nair occasionally doesn't look like shit, and in those moments, we misperceive the amount of harm that she's doing to the U.S. women at large. That's so harsh to say, but it's because Alyssa Nair was once a very great keeper and is demonstrating time and time and time again that she is costing full goals from mistakes that are sometimes mental, sometimes physical, sometimes a combination of both. And that's a huge problem if the U.S. want to win things.
This is the new normal, and it is not helpful, nor has it been for a good couple of years, to just rest on the laurels of she's the Secretary of Defense. Oh my God, she's the greatest. She's so cold. She, you know, she doesn't blink. Her pulse doesn't rise above 60. You don't understand. Like the 1 millimeter against Lena Hertig in the round of 16 changed her, and she's like a phoenix rising from the ashes. Like, shut the fuck up.
I just hear a whole bunch of narrative.
Whole bunch of narrative.
Narrative.
That's another segment. God. Maybe that's the segment.
Oh my God, let's just calling it narrative.
Let's just engage with the narrative.
Yeah, engaging with the narrative. Let's just talk the Twyla Kilgore era. I don't think there's anything really left to say about two friendlies that are well-branded. The Kilgore era.
Let's establish some basic facts about the Twyla Kilgore era. Obviously, she took over as interim head coach in September. She is going to stay on as assistant coach come June when Emma Hayes comes in. She ended up being the head coach for 14 games. That's actually a lot, even for the U.S., which plays a lot of friendlies. That's a nice, healthy chunk of time in only less than 7 months, basically. So there's a decent sample size that we can kind of get a sense of like what she was doing.
Oh, yeah.
14 games, 8 of them friendlies. The first 4 against South Africa and Colombia, September, October, you can write off because it's World Cup hangover slash, all right, let's bring Shaw and Moultrie in, Corbin Albert in, see what happens. But 6 competitive games across the Gold Cup in February and early March. So 10 wins, 3 draws, 1 loss. Among the competitive games, it was 4 wins, 1 draw, which I'm counting the semifinal as a draw since it went to penalties, and 1 loss, which was the Mexico game, which I think everybody agrees is the nadir of the program under Kilgore. She blooded Jaden Shaw, Olivia Moultrie, Corbin Albert, and Jenna Nieswanger. I think we can call all of those hits, except for one, but maybe for more off-the-field reasons than on-the-field ones. She brought back Sam Coffey and Casey Krueger to the point where now it does seem like Sam Coffey is the quarterback of the team, which she should have been at the World Cup, but now everyone is just finally going to agree to erase that mistake. Mal Swanson and Kat Macario came back after injury just for the She Believes Cup, which is incredibly important. And I don't think I need to say why. And then another wrinkle is that Alex Morgan managed to work her way back into the team because Mia Fischel tore her ACL. And also she brought Lily Johannes and Ava Gaetino into camp. They haven't gotten capped yet, but now they've had senior national team experience. Everybody knows that Lily Johannes is going to be pretty important for the future of the U.S. women's national team, if not for the Olympics, then for 2027 and 2028 and 2031. She obviously did some important things. I think she experimented a little bit tactically to try and figure out how to best get a lot of these players working together and develop relationships. I think that a big knock against her is that she just keeps trying to shoehorn Alex Morgan in. We're not going to talk about it again, but when Morgan's there, you have to play a certain way, and that's not how the team needs to be set up for the long term. It might get results in the immediate, but looking down the road, we have a different type of forward that has been developed and has reached its peak or is entering its peak. And Alex Morgan doesn't fit that mold. It's frustrating that Morgan came back for She Believes and got so much time at the Gold Cup. You wonder what that means for the friendlies against South Korea and Mexico and what it means for the Olympics. I think that the game against Japan in She Believes, that 11 has probably gotten as close to the optimal 11 in my mind for the team. It wasn't perfect by any stretch, but it was awfully close. And you'd think that, okay, well, if there's proof of concept there, barring those first 30 seconds in that opening goal, that unit is basically swap Smith in and take Morgan out. And that unit is basically the unit that you want.
Yeah, I think that's probably not that far from right. That said, Evan, let her grade me. The Kilgore era.
I think it's a B.
I was going to give her a B plus.
Yeah.
A B+.
Yeah, I think it's a B. A lot of her game day personnel decisions I did not think were useful, knowing that the team should be preparing for 2027 and that should be its primary objective. But she got results. They won the Gold Cup. Jaden Shaw and Olivia Moultrie got a lot of playing time. Trinity Rodman is also someone who is clearly an in-ink member of the starting 11, which maybe you wouldn't have known that based on the way Vlatko Andonovski and Kilgore in the early friendlies deployed their forwards. It's a little of this, it's a little of that. There are still a lot of tactical kinks to work out based on how they played against Mexico in the Gold Cup, how they played at times in the She Believes Cup. But ultimately, it felt like Kilgore's job was to erase the dot on the top of a lowercase I in pencil, whereas Hayes is the one who now gets to come in with the massive rubber eraser and just start scrubbing the whole page. So it's hard to knock Kilgore for doing this or that because she was always a lame duck from the moment Hayes was hired. She moved the ball a little bit forward, maybe moved the ball a little bit further back. I put a little list of four possibilities for her. Did she hold serve? Did she advance the development of the team? Did she hold the team back or did she actively regress the team? And I think she held serve when all is said and done.
I think that in some ways, advancing development and holding the team back are different sides of the same question. For me, the Kilgore era it's a series of meaningless friendly results that were never that convincing, followed by a solid recovery in the knockout stage of the Gold Cup after a not particularly convincing group stage, followed by a team that continues to be its own worst enemy. There isn't active regression as the sort of bucket, but I do think in some ways, continuing to rely on Alex Morgan and Alyssa Nair is almost unforgivable. And I understand why Alex Morgan was brought in. The crutch of Alex Morgan appears, and it kind of derails where there could have been room for advancement. The Gold Cup for me is this total missed opportunity to really experiment and to potentially not win, but to figure out a lot more about what the youth on hand is going to be. And instead, it sort of became the Alex Morgan show. Even down to Alex Morgan taking responsibility for the Corbin Albert stuff.
Quote unquote, taking responsibility.
The Alex Morgan crutch is really this obnoxious little bug of the Kilgore era that I think, if it makes its way over to the Hayes era, is a real problem. Does actually hold the team back, does actually fail to advance development. While I think hold serve is probably right, I saw this inclination in the Kilgore era to go back to the old sauce. And I think what it ended up creating were a lot of unconvincing results. And like, that's fine.
I was thinking about your comment after the Gold Cup final where we joke, oh man, is the U.S. becoming Italy men grinding out Catenaccio results? And that felt like what USA Canada was at times because Kilgore played a double pivot, but specifically with Coffey and Sonnet next to each other, which is an incredibly defensively minded play. And also using Alex Morgan essentially as another central midfielder. That's how often and also how deep she was dropping to get involved in play. Now, there have been times when even when I have felt frustrated with the decision to both start Morgan and use her in this way, you can sort of see the argument that people make, which is, well, nobody else on the U.S. is getting involved or making themselves available to contribute to the attack in central channels. And therefore, Morgan has to drop deep and be a link-up player and play with her back to goal and allow people to run beyond her and get involved. Or the other bugbear, which we all laugh at, is, oh, she occupies the center backs, which creates space for other people to operate in. But this really was the first time where that did not make any goddamn sense at all, because Shaw, Smith, Rodman, Macario, and Swanson were all available and all played at one time or another. These are not pieces that need help getting involved in the final third and in the box. So all of a sudden, you just had bunch ball in the middle of the park, and Morgan, rather than creating space or holding and linking up and bringing others into play, was just sort of gumming up the works. Going forward, with those five attackers healthy and available, there's just no argument anymore for why you would want to play Catenaccio and use Morgan in the way that she has been used. If you want to say that she still deserves to be a super sub and like come on late in games and try and steal a goal if you need a result, you can make that argument. I don't know if I'd agree with it, especially with the smaller Olympics roster size. But as a starter, as the figure around which you build your attack, these two games really were the first time where you had no argument. There was no argument to make for Morgan to be a core member of the starting 11.
Alex Morgan scored only one goal from open play in the Twyla Kilgore era. When you think about the number of minutes committed to her, it's just kind of irresponsible, particularly with where we're headed.
Yeah, it's like what that colleague of mine said about the Seattle Reign and Jordan Heidema. Yeah, it's nice that you defend so much, but it would be better if you scored because you're a forward.
Goals matter as a center forward.
And miss me with the whole, well, she's creating space for others and making her team better by being there argument. No, she's taking up space that could be better filled by someone else.
I just don't think that we take a look at the games that Alex Morgan played in and you say, wow, she facilitated. Those were just rampant goal scoring affairs. They just weren't. All right, so let's talk about who we see now that the Kilgore era is over. Who's going to the Olympics? Let's do our should lineup, and then we can talk about who will actually take those places. You pick a keeper, I'll pick a keeper.
Okay, Jane Campbell. Like, there's about 30 or 31 players who are in the pool. I think that's what we should work with.
Let's move on to center backs. How many center backs end up going?
I think three.
Yeah, I think that it's three or four, depending on who's taken. Let's go with three. I'll say that Sam Staub should be going, but we won't use her for the sake of this. So who are the three?
I think it's Girma, Davidson, and Dahlkemper.
I would prefer Alana Cook over either Dahlkemper or Davidson, but I think you're probably right. I think I would also probably prefer Sarah Gordon just on the back of the Oshawala defense and her excellent start to this season. But I think Girma's the one that we agree, but I think you're probably right that it's Davidson and Dahlkemper. All right, moving on to fullback. How many are we taking? Probably three.
Three, yeah. I'm not counting Crystal Dunn as a fullback for this experiment. So I think it's Emily Fox, Jenna Neiswanger, and Casey Krueger.
There's some flexibility tactically with three center back, with all of them actually, in various ways. But I think that's probably right. Let's talk about the base of midfield. We're assuming a 4-2-3-1.
Or a 4-3-3, yeah, with obviously flexibility on how you play it.
So if we've got eight already selected, we only have 10 left to go.
This is where it gets interesting.
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting. Sam Coffey should be going.
Yes, correct. Correct.
So we could just take that one off the list. I suspect Corbin Albert will weather this social media bullshit storm, and she might still get booed, but I think she's a better player at this point. I think she was one of the brighter lights play style-wise. I think for reasons that are not related to how she's playing, I would leave her off the team myself, but that's not what I suspect will happen, unless it's far more fractured than I think it is.
We are one non-apology redemption profile either in The Athletic or some glossy magazine for this all to be swept under the rug. The fact that the team is sticking so firmly to the "we're handling this matter internally" line indicates as such, especially because it doesn't seem like there's actually any tangible punishment coming her way. She came on as a substitute in both She Believes Cup games, so she's not losing minutes.
So if you're taking two number sixes to give yourself some flexibility, I guess I actually, now that we've talked our way through it, I don't want Corbin Albert on this. I take Emily Sonnet. It's just as a makeup thing. Also, it gives you an extra center back in the case you need it. I actually now, with an 18-person roster, see the logic in Emily Sonnet over Corbin Albert. So we're at 10 now. We have the base done. This is where it gets really hard.
Let's go with forwards, because I think that's probably a clearer picture.
I think of out-and-out strikers, the only one that I put in ink is Sophia Smith. So Swanson, Smith, Rodman, book 'em.
Book 'em.
So we're at 13.
Yeah. Now We talk about number 8, number 10, and maybe one or two players who could be considered winger slash number 10 slash number 9 hybrid. The list I have right now are Lindsey Horan, Taylor Flint, Crystal Dunn, Rose Lavelle, Olivia Moultrie, Jaden Shaw, Katerina Macario, Savannah DeMello, and Ashley Sanchez. Which five are you going with?
I love Lindsey Horan as a player. It's impossible for me to imagine she's not going to be, barring some injury.
If you're talking about a player that can shuttle...
Yeah, no. Her dynamism is huge here.
Playing deep, winning balls, and also progressing and playing as a number 10, although I don't think that's her best spot, is valuable. Okay, now we're really getting into the thin end of the wedge. I don't think you and I are going to have the same four picks here.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I am going Jaden Shaw.
Yep, me too.
Crystal Dunn.
Me too.
Katerina Macario.
Me too. Okay, now we're at the moment, for the real moment, the moment I knew where we might... diverge.
I like that you were like, I bet they're totally different, and I just rattled off three clear ones.
But the three I expect, if we did agree, that's where we'd agree. So
those were not surprising to me. There's a Morgan Weaver-sized hole here, I'm not going to lie.
and it won't get filled with her, anyway. I think it's clearly one of two of the five remaining names on this list. I think it's pretty clear it's between two players.
I think it's Olivia Moultrie.
I knew you were going to say that. I'm saying it's Rose Lavelle.
But that's all about fitness.
Yep.
I began the season wishing Rose Lavelle an MVP campaign in a totally healthy year, and the universe jinxed Rose Lavelle. So I think the odds that Rose Lavelle is healthy for the Olympics, and I think you just can't take a health risk like that for such a condensed tournament.
Yeah, if Lavelle isn't 90 minutes match fit, then I agree with you, it's Moultrie. But I found it very telling that throughout both the Gold Cup and the She Believes Cup, the teenager who really began to establish herself in the side was Shaw, and it wasn't Moultrie, which makes me wonder just how comfortable Moultrie is right now. I'm not saying that Moultrie won't be a starting midfielder in 2027, but I think for this moment right now, I think she's probably the first alternate, but that's as far as she goes. Because it's been up and down with Portland too, these first few games.
I think she has not started her club season off in a great way. I think a lot of it has less to do with her. My actual gut says you just take Lynn Williams. If you're not going to give me the option of taking Morgan Weaver or Jalen Howell, you take Lynn Williams.
Rather than Lavelle?
Yeah, because you're getting this extra defensive work rate and this finishing, but you're also allowing Smith to play on the left, which gives you, I think, a lot more freedom to move around pieces in a way that you don't necessarily have otherwise. If we're down to Lavelle, Moultrie, and Lynn Williams, I think I would rather have a Lynn Williams there than either Moultrie or Lavelle, unless Lavelle is healthy.
If you say Williams, I'd probably flip Williams and Smith, keep Smith central, put Williams on the left. That helps plug a defensive hole on the left wing that has been visible for a few games now, and allows Smith to create centrally and dribble centrally, which is where she's most comfortable. But also, I don't love Williams starting if you take her. I would rather have Swanson as your left winger and Rodman as your right winger, or flip those two.
No, but she provides a really nice target if you're chasing a goal.
Sure.
And she provides really great defensive cover if you're preserving a lead.
Having Shaw there, you really want to have Shaw play as the 10. It's where she's most comfortable. When she moved centrally in the second half against Canada is when she looked her best, rather than being on the wing. So that theoretically would make Lavelle surplus to requirements, because they're both comfortable on the ball and are very incisive. I could see an argument to be made to drop Lavelle in favor of Williams as a bench piece and then using Shaw as your starting 10. I see that. I just think that there's nobody like Rose Lavelle when she's healthy. I just think if she's available, I think you got to take her.
Yeah, sure. Rose Lavelle has yet to demonstrate, even this season, a consistent run of health. It's not about Rose Lavelle as a quality player. It's just about the structure of the tournament itself and why Rose Lavelle, unless she is coming into it at peak fitness, is somebody I wouldn't rely on in a tournament structured exactly this way. I also don't love, given the physicality of the group that the United States is in, Australia and Germany can mix it up. Zambia, obviously, you need to have an eye on defensive demands. I don't think Rose Lavelle's the best personnel call for that three teams. As good as she is at just like slicing through holes.
It all comes down to what happens around Memorial Day here in the United States after Chelsea wrapped their season and Hayes packs up her bags and comes to Chicago, Atlanta. Where do you think she's going to move? Atlanta's obviously the long-term HQ for the Federation, but... she has a history in Chicago.
Jolly old Atlanta. I think you want the flexibility if you're in her shoes. It's probably New York or Los Angeles, right?
Well, U.S. soccer in the past has demanded that the head coach live in Chicago, where Soccer House was. And Ananofsky was the first coach to push back on that and say, no, I'm going to stay in Kansas City. But he's not that far from Chicago. So Hayes has sort of the theoretical pick of the litter if she does have free choice. And knowing the leverage that she had over U.S. soccer, she might have gotten that written into her contract. But Atlanta's a major airline hub, so she can get anywhere pretty easily.
Hope she likes Delta.
She also loves having access to the media, so New York and L.A. might be options.
Without an NWSL team there and the ability to just, like, go watch your own players in person, it, just given the structure of the league, it strikes me as if the NWSL, which is West Coast heavy, there's a logic. But frankly, I don't really care where she lives. That is up to her.
I just want her and Harry to be happy. And Harry really deserves it. That poor kid just been through the ringer with how nuts his mother is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Atlanta United's academy is very good.
Well, here's the thing. As we know, this kid hates soccer because it's always taking his mother away. So I don't think he's signing up for any academies.
Well, the Coca-Cola Museum's there.
You can see how much material we had to work with this week because it's come to this.
Oh my God, we're dying.
The conversation.
Yeah, just walk us out of here. I hate that we recorded for almost an hour and 10 minutes and that we're going to end up releasing something that's 26 minutes long.
I've been grasping at straws trying to find a segue that gets us into the plugs, but...
Yeah, you just plug away.
To no avail. Thanks so much for listening. Please rate us, review us, follow us either on the Expected Own Goals feed or the American Soccer Analysis feed, wherever you're getting our show. If you're going to rate us at all, please rate us 5 stars. Follow us on social media at XOwnGoals. That's the letter XOwnGoals, including Blue Sky. If you think we have an own goal, please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. Do we have any own goals? I don't think so. Thing off the top of my head.
Maybe. I don't remember, but you know what? We can own them next time. And if you are Emma Hayes' realtor, keep that information to yourself. Bye.
Bye.